Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about Russia's war against Ukraine, with a focus on a terrible event that occurred 10 years ago this week, when a Russian missile fired from territory held by Russia-backed forces brought down a civilian passenger plane, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, or MH17, killing all 298 passengers and crew. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is a journalist who has done a lot of reporting in the Donbass, some of it in the aftermath of the downing of MH17. In fact, just a few days after the tragedy, he and a fellow journalist tracked down the spot where the Russian Buk launcher had stood in a farmer's field when it fired the missile that brought the plane down. My guest is Christopher Miller, Ukraine correspondent for the Financial Times and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine, a book that was published last year. Thank you very much for joining me, Chris.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to come back and join you when I can, Steve. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to have you again. Appreciate it. I'd like to first focus on MH17. 10 years ago this Wednesday, July 17th, 2014, the passenger plane was shot down with a Buk missile fired from a launcher that had been brought into Ukraine from Russia and was moved back across the border into Russia shortly afterwards. As I said, all 298 people on board were killed. The wreckage was strewn across a rural area in the Donetsk region. The Boeing was flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, and the passengers were from, I believe, 10 countries, the majority of them Dutch. Many were headed to see relatives or to go on vacation or home. It was July. There were 80 children among the dead. In fact, one Australian couple lost their three children, ages 8, 10, and 12. In 2022, after a trial in absentia, a Dutch court convicted three Russians, including Igor Girkin, and a pro-Moscow Ukrainian of murder for their roles in the downing of MH17. And in 2023, international investigators said there were, quote, strong indications that Russian President Vladimir Putin was personally involved in the downing of the airliner, but they ended their eight-year probe as they had essentially run out of evidence. Chris, you had already done a lot of reporting in the Donbass, in eastern Ukraine, before MH17, and had spent time there before you became a journalist. And as I said, you and a colleague, Roland Oliphant of The Telegraph, managed to find what the investigators later confirmed was apparently the very spot where the Buk launcher was deployed in the hands of Russia-backed anti-Kiev forces when it shot the plane down. Could you tell me about that and also maybe more broadly about how this tragedy, just 3 months into the war in the Donbass, would end up affecting what has happened since?
Yeah, it's hard to believe that we're actually sitting here talking about 10 years passing since MH17 was shot down. This is a war that's been going on for a decade. And so it's hard to actually get my mind around it, because I remember the day that MH17 was shot down so vividly, and the following days, both myself and the journalist Roland Oliphant, who you mentioned, were on the scene of the downing in the immediate aftermath, and the following days with many other correspondents around the world who had descended on this crash site to look for evidence and to find out what had happened. Right, there was a ton of confusion in that moment. I'll also say that, you know, this was probably of covering, you know, in 10 years of covering Russia's war against Ukraine, this is probably the one single event that has affected me the most. I think about it often. There's hardly a day that goes by that I haven't thought about it. And I think that is because of the images, that are, you know, ingrained in my head of the bodies of these civilians that, had fallen to the ground after being shot out of the sky. But also because this event and the reason we're talking about it today has had such a large impact, I think, on the course of the war, the response or lack thereof by the West, you know, Vladimir Putin feeling emboldened. But just to step back a bit, because you mentioned the launch site, you know, this was part of the reporting that I was doing in the immediate aftermath of the shoot down of MH17. Roland and I had a sort of slow morning. I think it was 4 or 5 days after the downing, and we decided, you know, we might go out and take a look around. We had a hunch as to where the launch site could have been based on some U.S. intelligence that had been released, but was very general. My experience living in the region, as you mentioned, I lived there for 2 years between 2010 and 2012 and knew the geography of it very well. And then also some open source investigative journalists online who had posted a sort of map showing the general vicinity of where the missile that shot down the plane could have been located. So we went out there eventually with the sort of help of a farmer who pointed us in the direction of one of his fields that had caught on fire, found this launch site that was later confirmed to be the place where the Russian Buk missile that downed MH17 was fired from during the Dutch court case. You know, we're talking about this now, not only because 298 people were killed in this downing, but also because, you know, this event grabbed the world's attention at the time. You know, it has remained, I think, you know, relatively in the public eye over the course of this trial and conviction of the four men that you mentioned. It also really set, I think, this tone for the war going forward, that being, you know, Russia's continuous, if somewhat sort of you could use the sort of boiling frog metaphor here, right? Kind of slow escalation of things over the course of many years until its full-scale invasion. I would also argue that really the downing of MH17 and the West's lack of response, especially if you talk with Ukrainians about how they feel regarding the West's response after this, really emboldened Vladimir Putin. We saw tough sanctions applied to Russia, but ultimately not hard enough to dissuade Vladimir Putin in the future from continuing his aggression against Ukraine, and in many ways also against the West, right? We see these assassination campaigns that have played out over the years, disinformation campaigns. Another element of MH17 that has stuck with us is disinformation, right? In the immediate aftermath, Steve, you'll remember that, you know, Russian state media, bloggers, even its government was, you know, out there pushing all these outrageous various scenarios to try to persuade the public that a Russian missile was not used in the downing of this, that the crew that operated it was either not Russian or not Russian-led in eastern Ukraine. Some of these theories, you know, they range from the outrageous, I think, to a, you know, from a photoshopped jet on a Google map that looked like an obvious fake, to the more sophisticated disinformation of blaming Ukraine, saying that it had used a Buk and moved it close to the front line. There were several other scenarios thrown out there, but it seemed like every day we were hearing another theory. And this, you know, muddied the waters. It made it difficult for readers of newspapers around the world to really know what had happened. It also makes it, you know, difficult when you're trying to form policy, if you're a policymaker. So, you know, the disinformation that we're seeing from the Kremlin, but not only, that has spread across the world, I think is at least in part a product of, you know, this period of time when all of these alternative theories were pushed out there. In reporting on this, the other major thing I would say that is a product of this is open source investigations. So the open source investigative unit Bellingcat was famously the outfit that tracked the Buk missile launcher from Eastern Ukraine, or actually from Russia into Eastern Ukraine and back. And the collaborations between open source investigative journalists like those of Bellingcat, partnered with myself and journalists on the ground, really I think opened the door to a new style of reporting that has since won Pulitzer Prizes from many international media outlets. The New York Times is a good example. They won a Pulitzer, I think, last year for an investigation that was part on the ground, part open source, using visual investigative tools and open source research, right? Regarding, I think, the Bucha massacre in 2022 in Ukraine outside of Kyiv. So, that was another impact of this event. Broadly speaking, I think it really shocked the world and showed that while perhaps not intentional, and there's good reason to believe that this plane was mistaken for a Ukrainian military plane, it showed the lengths to which the Kremlin was willing to go to wage war against Ukraine. I would say largely against the West, to conceal its motives and actions in Ukraine. But it also did the opposite too. It actually showed, I think, more explicitly than the previous months of the first outbreak of war in 2014, the Kremlin's hand in its war in Ukraine. Up until that point, it had largely been about Russia-backed separatists, and there had been some plausible deniability, even if it felt a bit silly to some of those like myself on the ground. This, I think, made it impossible, really, for Moscow to claim that it wasn't involved anymore, because the amount of evidence that we had pointing to Russia, showed, I think, to the world its hand in this war.
Thanks, Chris. Interesting about the open source reporting or open source investigations, and of course, journalists, including yourself, were pretty instrumental in breaking ground on what was going on and what went on with the MH17 downing. So I think investigators were following the leads of journalists to some degree, at least. But I wanted to just ask a follow-up question a little bit. I mean, you've kind of answered this maybe, but you said it shocked the world, and it sort of brought home to people how Russia was prepared to do. And you also said earlier that the kind of the reaction from the West or the lack of really decisive action, was something that has emboldened Putin. Let me just ask the question, did you expect, I remember, a lot of people were saying right after it happened, this is a game changer, this changes everything. Did you think it would change things more than it ended up doing?
Yes, I did. I think there was a lot of hope in that this could be the turning point and the moment where the West realized what Russia was doing and would step in and help a Ukraine that was on the back foot, very much so, that had a very small military at that point. You'll remember after the annexation of Crimea that the Ukrainian military was in disarray, and a lot of the people who jumped into the fray to join Ukraine's defense in the Donbas were volunteers, largely from the revolution just a few months earlier. They were very inexperienced and needed and were asking for a lot of help from the West. And I think after this, those of us who were on the ground and seeing these atrocities committed, including the MH17, but not only, we're really convinced that, this must be the Rubicon and Russia has passed it. Now we're going to see not only sanctions, but we're going to see much more, a heavier, more direct involvement in Ukraine's defense by the West. And, I honestly was surprised when I think that, when that didn't come. And certainly my Ukrainian friends and journalist colleagues and the leaders who I've interviewed over the years, were very, very disappointed in the West's response and found it to be weak. And I think now, looking in hindsight, many of us would agree that that weak response only emboldened the Kremlin and led eventually to Russia building up its forces, laying out its plan for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and then launching that invasion of Ukraine in 2022.
Thanks very much, Chris. Now, I want to turn to more recent events that have followed that full-scale invasion. Maybe you could give us a brief overview of how you see this moment in the war based on your reporting and your observations. Clearly, this past winter and spring were a very tough time for Ukraine and its forces at the front, with a delay in U.S. weapons deliveries, undermining their ability to defend the country. Now, things seem a bit better in that regard now, but Russia is making slow gains and is also launching relentless attacks that are hitting not just civilian infrastructure, but civilians themselves, as Russia has done throughout the invasion. A particularly stark example was the missile strike last week, a decade after MH17, on a children's hospital in Kyiv on July 8th. And I'll just add, maybe not as much or not as, but Russia was certainly emitting some attempts to muddy the waters as to what happened in that strike on the children's hospital. So, but Chris, apologies for the broad question, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on what's happening now.
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the sort of general overview, and then if you have more specific follow-up questions, I can elaborate on them. On the missile attack that you were speaking about on the Akhmadut is the correct pronunciation, hospital last week. Yeah, we did see some disinformation around there in Russia trying to, deflect reporting and blame for the attack. It's become very clear since that a Russian missile destroyed the hospital. But they were in a very similar way to the MH17 downing, trying to deflect blame over that attack. Generally, right now, you're right in that things are looking a little bit better and a little bit more stable for Ukraine on the battlefield. The American military assistance that was delayed for 6 months really did set Ukraine back. It caused, a huge amount of casualties. It allowed Russia to gain momentum on the battlefield and to make gains on the battlefield. The city of Avdiivka being one place in particular that the Russians were able to take after, the Ukrainians had put up a really strong defense there for a decade. So, at this point, this military assistance lines, it's helping to stabilize those front lines. The Russian incursion into northeastern Kharkiv region has been shut down. The Ukrainians have managed to push the Russians back just slightly. They're trying to push them back further. I don't know whether or not that's going to happen, but they've at least stopped the Russians from advancing closer to Ukraine's second largest city of Kharkiv. In the east, in Donetsk region, that's the area of the greatest concern right now and where the fighting is the hottest. The Russians are still advancing on the battlefield toward the towns of New York and Toretsk. Both of those places are getting pounded pretty heavily at the moment. They're making gains on the ground around or southeast rather of Pokrovsk, which is a really key strategic city. It's a logistical hub for Ukraine and the military. It sits on one of the most the most important highway connecting all of the cities of Donetsk Oblast that remain under Ukrainian control. So Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, Druzhkivka, all of these places are connected via this highway that runs through Pokrovsk. And the Russians are within about 6 or 7 kilometers of that road. So they're already able to lob artillery, small artillery fire at this road, and also larger weaponry toward Ukrainian soldiers, military vehicles, logistical vehicles that are coming and going from the front and supplying those troops with these Western weapons. On the artillery front, the gap used to be rather wide in regards to what Russia was able to fire versus what Ukraine is able to respond with. I think that ratio was about 10 to 1 to maybe even 15 to 1 at its worst in the winter. It's now closed to be about maybe 2 to 1, maybe upwards of 4 to 1 in some places. But the Ukrainians I've spoken to have said, we do have artillery shells now. We're able to respond, not necessarily shell for shell, but they're now able to better defend themselves. The drone war is constantly, always heating up. New developments are happening every 3 months or so. One side will come up with some kind of new drone invention or a new way to jury-rig these drones to become, killer drones and weapons on the battlefield that they've used. Both sides have used very effectively. And then a few weeks later, the Russians or the Ukrainians will come up with a way to counter those drones, whether it's using an electronic warfare device or some other method. So there's still a constant sort of technological back and forth with each side, trying to one up the other. You mentioned actually before the battlefield, before I move away from the battlefield, I'll mention also that the United States, you'll recall last week during the NATO summit, announced that F-16s will finally be delivered, and we're already en route to Ukraine. So that's a big development. Ukrainians have wanted them for 2 years now. They're finally starting to arrive. These are not going to be, any sort of magic bullet. They're not going to change the course of the war. They're not going to be used, as far as I am aware, for offensive actions. They're largely going to be used to help Ukraine with its air defense, which it's still lacking. There have been new commitments from the United States in particular, but also European countries, to provide Ukraine with additional Patriot systems or this IRIS-T system that will help protect cities and critical infrastructure. The F-16s are going to be useful in also shooting down Russian missiles and attack drones, but also likely Russian aviation and missiles that are targeted at Ukrainian positions along the front line. What else? You mentioned the energy situation. Now, energy security is, if not the biggest issue right now, certainly near the very top. Ukraine has lost, probably 70%, if not a little bit more, of its power generation capacity. That's because Russian missiles have managed to pierce its air defenses or sneak through them and target power plants across the country, including around Kiev. So I'm speaking with you now from New York. I'm on a break here for a few weeks, but in Kiev just before I left, and still to this day, because I'm speaking with friends over there now, we have been without power for at least half the day, usually much more than that. In some areas of Ukraine, cities are struggling with just about 6 to 8 hours a day of power. It's only going to get worse in the winter. Ukraine is not going to be able to restore the power that it has, the power generation capacity that it's lost. It's going to be able to import a small amount from the EU, but this winter is going to be dark. It's going to be very cold. That's going to have a serious impact on the morale of the public. And right now, that this is a Ukrainian public that is already exhausted from not only 2 years of full-scale warfare, but also 10 years of war. It's a population now, according to polls, that is starting to consider what the future of the country might look like and whether or not negotiations should be had. And just before we spoke here, I was reading the latest polling from the Razumkov Center in Kiev, which said that, and I wrote this down just to be sure, 40%, 44% of Ukrainians now believe that the time for negotiations has arrived. But, and this is the big catch, a majority of them do not agree to the terms laid out for peace by Vladimir Putin earlier this month. Now, those terms, of course, were essentially a demand for Ukraine to capitulate. And so Ukrainians want this war to end. They want some form of peace. They don't want it to be on Russia's terms. They want it to be, of course, on completely on Ukrainian terms. That's, seems unlikely, and it tells me that a settlement is still a long way off. But I would say anecdotally, one thing that I hear a lot from the leadership in Ukraine right now is, we do need to consider what the future will look like, what negotiations might look like, when they could happen. And they are, behind the scenes, starting to discuss this and plan this. And publicly, this, topic of negotiations used to be completely taboo. And then recently, that taboo has been broken. And now we're seeing commentary on Facebook, which is very popular in Ukraine, on other social media channels, Telegram in particular, television, certainly in the written online media, and then this polling being widely shared and discussed. So I think it's to look at the big picture, I think it's going to be a very interesting year in that there might not be, I don't expect any major breakthroughs on the battlefield. I think both armies are in a relatively strong position at the moment. Ukraine has weapons enough to defend itself well if it uses them wisely for the rest of the year and probably into 2025. Russia's economy, of course, is on a war footing. It hasn't had the manpower issues that Ukraine has in getting soldiers for the fight. It's been recruiting upwards of 30,000 soldiers a month because the Kremlin has decided to pay them very well. It's producing a lot of materiel. So I think on the battlefield, it's more or less going to be a deadlock, but I think politically, there's going to be a lot more maneuvering. And then, of course, the wild card is what will happen with the US elections in November. And that could have a big impact on future negotiations. It's probably sometime in 2025 or possibly before the end of the year. I think that there is an interest in Ukraine perhaps starting to discuss negotiations possibly before November in hopes that the Biden administration could perhaps use some of its leverage to get involved. But I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like, and there's still a lot of talk behind the scenes in Kyiv about what would be feasible. But these polls, I think, are really interesting and an indication that going forward, Ukraine is looking for a way out.
Thanks, Chris. That's, I mean, great detail about many aspects. And you kind of anticipated a couple of possible follow-up questions I was going to ask about, the energy situation, and morale, as well. And of course, the U.S. election is a good place. Would be a good place to end it. I'm just going to ask one other question. This is kind of in the news today, I guess. Today, this I'm talking about mobilization of Ukrainian forces. I believe today was the last day under the new law for men who are of fighting age to register or submit documents. I don't know the details, but how would you say that's playing into the situation and, and into morale?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, Ukrainian men aged 18 to 16 have until tomorrow, July 16th, to register on the mobile app called Dia, which is basically them putting in all of their personal information, updating it, and saying, essentially everybody who's eligible for the military draft, has to go into the system and register themselves to be available for possible conscription. If you don't do that, and I think certainly there are some men who won't, you could be fined. The longer you wait to do it, the more you'll be fined. And there's some concern among men that I've spoken to who are debating whether or not to register before the deadline. That they could be potentially targeted for not registering and maybe conscripted sooner. So there is a lot of talk still about mobilization and the draft. There is well, to paraphrase a Ukrainian friend of mine who is a military-aged man in his late 20s, there's no casual get together that happens among men these days that doesn't involve the discussion of mobilization and how they will respond if they're called up. Some people will reluctantly join. Others, you know, have come up with some sort of plan to dodge the draft. That might mean going in hiding or finding a way to serve in a position in the military rear rather than in the front line, meaning someplace in an office or an administrative position. Others are considering paying large sums of money to smugglers who could help them get out of the country. This is all to say that manpower remains a major issue for Ukraine, and by that I mean they need troops still. They are mobilizing more men now since the new mobilization law came into force in May. I won't say the exact number, although I have a very good sense of what that is, but I will say it's more than 10,000 new soldiers mobilized each month, and less than 20,000 a month. You know, that has really helped. They're not as desperate for new troops as they were before. But what this means is they're adding new soldiers into the fight, but they're not still demobilizing those who have been fighting for many years. So you have a military with an average age of the average soldier's age being around 43 or 44, with troops who, while experienced, are exhausted. They've been fighting for years. They're desperate for a break. There's no demobilization in sight. This was stripped out of the mobilization bill, and parliamentarians had said that they would address it again in a separate bill, but they still have not. You know, this is a war that is grinding on, right? This is a war of attrition, and that attrition means, you know, exhaustion. It means a great loss of life. It's a really difficult fight. We all see, you know, the videos from the battlefield, and you know, there are not a lot of men right now who want to run to the front line and join up. The really gung-ho patriotic types already joined up in 2022, you know, when Russia launched its full-scale invasion. So we're not seeing that drive to run to defend the country like we did, you know, 2 years ago. It's a country that is very much, you know, tired from this war and is, you know, essentially holding on for dear life. They are in a better place than they are than they were 6 months ago, but it's still a long, you know, a difficult fight ahead, and manpower will remain an issue.
All right. Well, very, very detailed on that issue and many others, and a great overview of what's happening at this point, and also going back to MH17 near the beginning of the war, essentially. In Ukraine, Russia's war in Ukraine. And I'm going to stop there and wrap it up. Thank you very much for joining me, Chris.
Thank you for having me on again.
All right. The pleasure is mine. Once again, I've been speaking to Christopher Miller, Ukraine correspondent for the Financial Times and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine, which was published last year. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.